You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Sheet Metal Workers Local 2 and Teamsters Local 41. Sheet Metal Workers Local 2 represents 1,200 members in western Missouri and eastern Kansas. We start with the sheet metal and make nearly anything out of it for industry, heating and air conditioning, architectural roofs and siding, kitchens, and even works of art. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. We thank our underwriters for their support, the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, longshore oil and auto strikes, near strikes, and threatened strikes. Will they turn around labor's fortunes? We talk to the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Craig Merrilies, then to Emil Ramirez, District Director of the United Steelworkers, about the oil workers' unprecedented strike over safety at our oil refineries. And finally, we'll talk about the auto negotiations with the Big Three, and which begin soon, and the issue there is two-tier wages. And we'll talk to a representative from United Auto Workers Local 249 who went to the bargaining convention. In the news, community leaders call out Senator Kurt Schaefer, Representative John Deal, and Governor Jay Nixon for the crisis in the state of Missouri's Family Support Division. And what do dads get for paternity leave in other countries? What do they get here? Now for the news.
The merger between American Airlines and US Air is in the final stages. On Wednesday, American received their single operating certificate from the Federal Aviation Administration. According to American, it's the culmination of more than 18 months of work aligning the carrier's operating policies and procedures. The process isn't over yet for the workers. Now the two unions, which represent many of the American and U.S. Air employees, the International Association of Machinists, and the Transport Workers Union, will have to negotiate an unprecedented joint contract for the mechanics and ground workers. These contracts cover about 18,000 mechanics and a total of 50,000 workers.
As Kansas City organizes for another fast food strike on April 15th, demanding $15 an hour and a union, it's important to remember that real lives are in the balance. The fast food organizers released the following statement today. One of our key leaders, Dana Whitman, lost her 20-year-old son. He committed suicide Monday morning. The news has sent us all reeling. We're in the process of taking care of her and helping her to raise funds to cover funeral costs, which are about $1,600. We'd also like to raise a little more to help her get back on her feet. In the days before the tragedy, Dana and her son were being evicted, recently lost their lights, and her son's baby was taken from the home due to the loss of utilities. All of this underscores with absolute clarity what we know about low wages. They are killing workers, mind, body, and soul. If you'd like to donate to help Dana with the funeral expenses, go to http://www.mc-ed.org/donate-html.
Ever wonder what parents in other countries get in leave when they have a baby? Well, a union member with a new baby is taking 7 weeks of paternity leave as per his contract. He decided to investigate what workers in other countries get. Here's what he found. Fathers in the Bahamas and Singapore, by law, get 1 week. Kenya, Venezuela, Australia, Denmark, and the United Kingdom get 2 weeks. In Spain, dads get 15 days, and in Portugal, they get 20. The winter dads, though, are in Finland, where they get 54 days. That's almost 8 weeks, and Iceland, where they get 3 months or over 12 weeks. Of course, in the U.S., by law, you get zero. Kansas City Jobs with Justice Workers Rights Board on Wednesday issued a scathing report on the reorganization of the Missouri Family Support Division, a crisis that will only be exacerbated by the state legislature's proposed budget cuts. Community leaders from the Workers' Rights Board gathered in front of the Fletcher Daniels Building yesterday to announce the release of the report called Regarding the Reorganization of the Missouri Family Support Division. The report documents the findings of a hearing the group held in November where community leaders heard testimony from FSD workers, clients, and advocates. In addition to releasing its report, the Workers' Rights Board of Kansas City Jobs with Justice denounced the budget currently being proposed by the state legislature, which cuts services to the Family Support Division even more, as well as other social service departments. The group called upon Senator Kurt Schaefer and Speaker of the House John Deal to reverse the proposed cuts to the state's social service infrastructure. The group also called on Governor Jay Nixon not to implement any more staff reductions to the Family Support Division. Missouri has been failing to adequately support the Family Support Division of the Department of Social Services for many years. FSD employees are among the lowest paid in the entire country, and this has contributed to a high rate of turnover in the division. This problem has only grown since the governor and state legislature eliminated several hundred positions from the division in fiscal year 2009-2010. In 2012, the FSD administration announced a reorganization process that would lead to the elimination of an additional 700 staff positions from FSD over the course of 4 to 7 years. This reorganization process has proved to be nothing short of a disaster. This past year has seen a 15% decrease in the number of children and adults receiving temporary assistance. The number of children receiving federally subsidized child care benefits has dropped by 12,300. Between 2009 and 2014, the number of food stamp recipients in Missouri dropped, while there was a 27.4% increase in food stamp recipients nationally. These statistics are not because Missourians are doing better financially. They're the result of an understaffed and broken Family Support Division. Dr. Bob Miner, chair of the Kansas City Jobs with Justice Workers' Rights Board and professor emeritus of the University of Kansas, said, "The Kansas City Workers' Rights Board's message through this report and in light of more recent administrative and legislative proposals is clear. Now is not the time to cut jobs from a division that already lacks the capacity to meet the needs of Missouri's citizens. Now is the time to restore the Family Support Division to its pre-reorganizational strength. The people of Missouri deserve a strong, accessible Family Services Division." Lucy Torres, past president of Empower Missouri, said, "The caseworkers at FSD are overwhelmed and need more staff. But current budget proposals in the Missouri legislature calls for cutting another 120 staff. This would result in still longer delays and suffering from Missouri's most vulnerable citizens." The news tonight was read by Greg Swartz, Molly Madden, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Good evening and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Michael Savoie, and my guest this evening from United Steelworkers is District Director, District 11, Emil Ramirez. Good evening, Emil. Are you with us?
Good evening, Michael.
Yeah. We are happy to have you on the Heartland Labor Forum, and a lot of activity across the organizing lines already this year. We've got Your union there with the all workers, dock workers have had action, auto contracts are up. Could you describe for us, Emo, what the issues were in what's been called the largest strike in the oil industry in 35 years?
Well, there were several issues. Probably the most important issues is the contracting out of what we felt was bargaining unit work in the facilities, and we understand how these large refineries operate, that you do have to have turnaround, and there are a call for contractors in those facilities that are needed. What we were finding is that the maintenance and training development wasn't happening in these facilities, and instead of hiring employees that we represent when people retired, the company was contracting that work out, and we saw an erosion of the day-to-day work of the bargaining unit members at a majority of these facilities. Mm-hmm. That was probably one of the issues. Another issue is what is called fatigue management, and you hear the stories of employees working double shifts, and that is something that did not affect all of the facilities, but a majority of them, to where the hiring practices from the companies wasn't substantial enough to have cover when someone may have been ill or someone may have gotten upgraded into a different position, to where it forced an individual that was already working a 12-hour shift into working another six for what would be an 18-hour day, and then being off for 6 hours and returning to work to cover another normal shift. So those were probably the two biggest issues at most of the facilities that we had at the table.
Very good. I understand this may have been the first time that you've employed the auto industry style pattern bargain agreement. So the focus was on Shell and who set the tone for the national agreement. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I don't think this is the first time. There's always been a targeted company, and what usually happens is that we get an agreement, and the other major companies in the industry recognize it and accept it going forward, and that includes. Phillips, includes ExxonMobil, Marathon, and some other independent refineries. Mm-hmm. But that's been the pattern. Usually, it gets accepted by the other companies, and the other ratification moves forward. And we did have some difficulty in at this negotiations trying to get an agreement, and that's why we had the work stoppage. January.
Indeed. Now you say work stoppage. From the research I did, I couldn't help but notice that actually the traditional strike where production is actually stopped didn't really occur. You had more of a picket line up, but production continued. Could you explain to our listeners how that worked?
Well, we targeted, locations that we thought would we'd have an advantage and we didn't take the whole all the industry out. It started out, with a half a dozen locations, and then we increased it as the work stoppage lasted, and we weren't able to get an agreement. There was some Shell locations, on the Gulf Coast. We had some BP locations also that were affected. I think that Tesoro is a bigger player in this, and so how that came about is our National Oil Bargaining Policy Committee, along with our international designated, what they felt was strategically a goal of trying to really target a few refineries in different places across the country.
Yeah. Emil, there have been a lot of accidents at all refineries there, and I understand that safety has been high on the list of your members' concerns. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Safety is, just a personal experience. The first time I went into a refinery And, you know, people don't realize the danger that the operators are in on a daily basis. They're at a facility. If you don't have the right equipment or if you don't have the right gasket for a coupling, you know, there's that danger of also, right offhand, you know, we've had a number of major fires in the facilities, in the last number of years. And, you know, in the last 10 years, we've had, you know, accidents at Tesoro facility in Anacortes, Washington, where we lost members in Texas City, Texas. You know, that is a concern, and the safety, and I think that was also to make sure that, you know, our training programs are fine, and I'm not saying that the safety was caused by inadequate contractor work or whatever, but there's some companies that maybe did not do the maintenance on a regular basis as should be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a concern for everyone that works in that industry, is making sure that we do have regular maintenance in the facilities, and making sure that our members, when they report any type of a dysfunction in the operation, that it gets the attention and we're able to get it corrected.
Yeah, I understand. One of the big concerns was the company-dominated safety committees there, and members were demanding that a bit more of involvement. In fact, the leadership of some of the safety committees. So you've had a tentative national agreement, Emma. Will the locals vote on that national agreement?
You know, the locals have been voting on that over, you know, the last, since, I guess, you know, since early March. And you know, we've been successful as we move across the, not only in the refineries, but also in the pipelines and getting those resolved. I can tell you that here in the Kansas City area, we've got a couple locations that we're working on here in Sugar Creek, the Sugar Creek pipeline for Buckeye and Partners, and then the terminal for Buckeye Partners here in Sugar Creek. We're close to hopefully getting an agreement, and we'll be getting those here this week. But what happens is that the national settlement is more or less crafted at the national level table, and then the locals, unions, also have issues that they try to resolve with the local management at their locations, and that has to be accepted to meet the national oil bargaining policy that was voted on last October by their delegates.
Mm-hmm. So all of the local riders or supplements will have to be approved before the national agreement is implemented.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we're getting close to that. We're getting a lot of those hopefully finished, and we're pretty optimistic that we think that hopefully here in the next week to 10 days that we'll have that slate clean.
Okay. Well, man, that sounds good. With the national oil surplus, in a sense, so we've seen the lowest prices at the pump since, for a good many years there. It seemed like maybe not the best time to take the industry on, but it sounds like you guys have done a great job, man, and challenging and, of course, winning the rights that are the agreement, at least, that you so desperately needed. So one other question I have, we got another minute or two. I understand that you guys have really kind of led the industry in creating a partnerships with the blue collar and the green concerns, the environmental concerns, and that you've made liaisons with our counterparts in Europe. Could you tell us a little bit about that in our last 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, you know, I can tell you, our Blue-Green Alliance, is that coalition is something that has been, when we started that in 2005, and it's, you know, we can't agree on all the issues, but I can tell you the ones that we do agree on, we work together on. And I can tell you that the members of the Blue-Green Alliance and were with us, standing with us, in fact, on the picket line with us at these locations across the country that were on strike. And, And, you know, we did send a delegation to Europe, and we got some strong allies there in the Netherlands and in the UK that stand with us on same type of issues. You know, they want safe places to work. They want a clean environment.
We're going to have to cut it there, Emo. I hate to say, but, you know, I want to thank you for being on the Heartland Labor Forum tonight, and I certainly recognize, man, that your work to align your interests and that of environmentals and in the European interests is certainly setting a precedent for the rest of labor. So thank you for being part of the Heartland Labor Forum tonight, and we certainly appreciate your sharing
you,
with
Michael.
Our listeners. Okie doke. Bye now.
Good night.
Let the God of prophets take their souls. And every time they tell us how they made it on their own, let the mighty power of them working people roll. Come on, union. Come on, union. Come on, union. All around the country, these old hard times coming down. The poor folks just get worse off every day. The rich man likes to tell us how the country should be run, saying that things are better while they take our jobs away. Come on, union. Come on, union. Come on, union. To think that I could handle things all by myself. The boss was happy with the job I'd done. When I said that I would have to have a dollar more, he told me that he just found someone else to take my run. Come on, union. Come on, union. Come on, union. 100 head of cattle down on old McDonald's farm, taking everything because they're dumb. They need someone to tell them that a stampede would be fun, and they wouldn't be around here when the cattle haulers come. Come on, union. Come on, union. Come on, union. All around the country, see them backing down, making them concessions one by one. Some say that it's better when you keep the jobs in town, but I say that if we don't stand, we'll crawl before we're done. Come on, union. Come on, union. Come on, union. Let them millionaires go down to Wall Street with their gold. Let the God of prophets take their souls. And every time they tell us how they made it on their own, let the mighty power of them working people roll. Come on, union. Come on, union. Come on, union.
And that was the late, great Larry Penn. The show tonight is all about unions and bargaining. And you heard about the oil workers' strike. Next, you're going to hear about the longshore workers' negotiations and near strike.
This is Diane Krauthammer, a reporter with the Heartland Labor Forum. Last Friday, April 3rd, delegates of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union in California voted to recommend approval of the tentative agreement reached on February 20th between the union and employers represented by the Pacific Maritime Association. This was a major step forward as the previous contract expired in July 2014. During the long months of negotiations, the Maritime Association, which is the multi-employer group that represents the big companies who control the docks, accused the union of engaging in slowdowns to gain leverage. Dozens of cargo ships were anchored off West Coast docks for months as the labor talks between the Longshore Union and the Maritime Association remained deadlocked. Union spokesperson Craig Merrilee said the contract, after being ratified, will include the following.
Some of the details include maintaining excellent health care benefits, an excellent pension plan, and controls on outsourcing that threaten to undermine good jobs around the ports. And the outsourcing involved chassis, the steel frame with wheels that employers need to get a container moved out of the yards and be hauled away by a truck to a warehouse or distribution center.
While the mainstream media's coverage of the so-called slowdown was deficient, leaving many to believe that the cargo backups were the fault of the workers, Merrilee's explained that outsourcing chassis units was the main cause of the delays that employers accused workers of creating.
And those chassis units used to come along with the container that was shipped across the ocean. But the companies decided they could save money by outsourcing those chassis units, and it had a dramatic impact and created a huge congestion and delay problem long before anybody started pointing fingers at workers and blaming them for the congestion problems. So this problem with port congestion was a long-standing problem, and a lot of it had to do with the decision to outsource chassis, because the firms that took over that business found it impossible to get a chassis connected to a container at the right place at the right time, and the resulting delays had a terrible domino effect and created huge backlogs.
He went into further details about the problems with outsourcing and its effects on workers.
There were terrible congestion and delay problems that were paralyzing the ports long before anyone started pointing fingers at union members and trying to blame them for the mess. It's true that workers were frustrated, and many of them were working in very dangerous conditions because of the employer-caused congestion problems, the outsourcing of chassis units, the use of much larger vessels, and the mixing of containers on many different lines that had to be sorted out when the vessels were unloaded at the ports were just some of the factors that contributed to congestion and delay problems that have been plaguing the ports for all of 2014. So at a certain point, you know, companies started to blame workers, and there were allegations of slowdowns. But the bulk of the problems at the ports have been industry caused, and employers use their own economic powers to try and gain leverage over workers by closing down operations, eliminating 2 out of 3 shifts, for example, every day after January 13th, plunging the ports into a huge shutdown mode that only allowed them to operate for 8 hours a day when previously they'd been a 24/7 operation. And then finally, shutting the ports entirely for days at a time, going so far as to closed them for 6 out of the last 10 days before an agreement was reached. So efforts were made by the companies and business interests to blame the workers for all these problems. But in fact, many of the problems were the result of industry decisions and industry economic action.
Of course, outsourcing is not the only issue that longshore workers face. A lack of safety plagues the industry as well.
Workers are killed at a greater rate than police and firefighters. So the work is already very dangerous, and working with heavy, dangerous equipment and these giant, massive containers is an inherently dangerous proposition. So anything that makes that more dangerous is something that causes a great deal of concern. And that's what happened when employers tried to force workers to operate heavy dangerous equipment at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach without having the proper training to do so safely. And that sparked a real conflict, and workers eventually drew the line and said that they would not work and not provide workers for those kinds of jobs, with this heavy equipment, unless they had been properly trained. And because the employers had refused to train workers, there was a standoff, and this resulted in a conflict in which the employers claimed there was a slowdown, and workers said that they were going to stand and demand the right to have proper safety training to make sure that anyone operating this heavy dangerous equipment could do so as safely as possible.
Overall, Merrilee said, the problems stem from the profit motives in the industry.
Many of the problems have been caused by industry decisions, decisions that may have made sense in the short run and made sense in terms of generating profit, but had huge consequences that affected the broader public interest. For example, cutting the quality of workers who do the inspection and maintenance of these truck chassis units, the steel frames with wheels that haul containers rolling down the highway at 60 miles an hour, they need to be inspected and they need to be safe. And when the companies decided to outsource that work, it didn't just affect workers, it affected everyone who drives on the highways and expects that equipment to be safe. So if the brakes aren't working and welds are broken, the attachments aren't secure, bad things can happen to a family in a minivan behind one of those units. So that's one example. Another example is the delays and the congestion that have resulted. And one reason is the terrible conditions that port truckers have been subjected to over the years. And the low pay and the miserable working conditions have driven away people and caused a shortage of drivers that's now growing. And yet the industry continues to have its head in the sand and continues to misclassify many of these workers as independent contractors in order to evade responsibility and duck labor laws and not have to pay Social Security and provide health insurance and decent pay. So that's one of many problems. Even the use of larger vessels, which is more efficient on the one hand and could allow for greater profits on the other, isn't really effective if there hasn't been proper planning and infrastructure developed at the ports to accommodate these larger vessels.
Ultimately, he said the best way to address these problems is for longshore workers to have a stronger voice.
Hopefully, under the new agreement, there'll be a much greater opportunity to work together on some of these problems because they're serious and they've been longstanding and they need to be addressed and can be addressed much better if everyone's working together and there's some common agreement that some of the decisions and the involvement of workers can be considered as well as just the opinions of the boss and the big companies.
The following track, called Song for Harry Bridges, was written in 1942 by Lee Hayes, Millard Lampel, and Pete Seeger, all members of the Almanac Singers, about ILWU founder Harry Bridges.
Let me tell you of a sailor, Harry Bridges is his name. An honest union leader who the bosses tried to brain. He left home in Australia to sail the seas around. He sailed across the ocean to land in Frisco town. There was only a company union, the bosses had their way. A worker had to stand in line for a lousy dollar a day. When up spoke Harry Bridges, us workers got to get wise. Our wives and kids will starve to death if we don't get organized.
Oh, the FBI is worried, the bosses, they are scared. They can't deport 6 million men they know. And we're not gonna let them send Harry over the sea. We'll fight for Harry Bridges and build the CIO.
They built a big bonfire by the mats and lines that night. They threw their pink books in it and they said, we're gonna fight. You've got to pay a living wage or we're gonna take a walk. They told it to the bosses, but the bosses wouldn't talk. They said there's only one way left to get that contract signed. And all around the waterfront they threw their picket line. They called it Bloody Thursday, the 5th day of July. 400 men were wounded and 2 were left to die.
Oh, the FBI is worried, the bosses, they are scared. They can't deport 6 million men, they know. And we're not gonna let them send Harry over the sea. We'll fight for Harry Bridges and build the CIO.
Now that was 7 years ago, and in the time since then, Harry's organized thousands more and made them union men. We must try to bribe him, the shipping bosses said. And if he won't accept the bribe, we'll say that he's a red. The bosses brought a trial to deport him over the sea. But the judge said, he's an honest man, I got to set him free. Then they brought another trial to frame him if they can. But right by Harry Bridges stands every working man.
Oh, the FBI is worried, the bosses, they are scared. They can't deport 6 million men, they know. And we're not gonna let them send Harry over the sea. We'll fight for Harry Bridges and build the CIO.
Tune in on Saturday afternoons for real, local, talk radio, community programming. Starting at 3 o'clock p.m., Every Woman with Sharon Lockhart and Amy Bell. 4 o'clock p.m., Urban Connections with Donna Morrow Wolf. 5 o'clock p.m., Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with M.C. Richardson.
On the next, Bioneers.
Asked why, Cesar responded. Because there is something even more important to farm workers than the benefits unionization brings. Because there is something more important to the farm workers' union than winning better wages and working conditions. That is protecting farm workers and consumers from systematic poisoning through the reckless use of agricultural toxins.
Friday morning, 9:30.
And welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. On March 24th and 25th, the United Auto Workers Union held a special bargaining convention in Detroit, Michigan. Delegates from around the nation met to discuss proposals for contract negotiations, which are set to begin this summer. Joining us on the phone is bargaining convention delegate and recently elected vice president of UAW Local 551 of Chicago, Illinois, Scott Holdison. Scott, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tino. How are you?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm great.
First, let me say from all of us here at the Heartland Labor Forum and myself, congratulations to you on your recent electoral victory.
You are
now vice president of 551. How does it feel?
Feels the same as before. It's all about organizing.
Right. How long have you been organizing within the UAW? I know that you've been in the official structure for some time, and then also as a rank-and-file activist.
I've been a rank-and-file activist for quite some time. I'm a 26-year union member and started attending union meetings, I'd say, within a year of joining the UAW. And, I like to write, so I put out flyers and informational leaflets to the membership on a regular basis. And I'm also the editor for our local union newspaper.
I'm sure Ford Motor Company loved all of your writing skills as soon as you hired in them. Isn't that right?
Well, they weren't too interested in my writing skills. They just wanted me to bust my butt on the line.
Right. What do you guys build out there at that facility?
We build the Ford Explorer, the Ford Taurus, and the Lincoln MKS.
Okay. So let's get right to this bargaining convention. Can you tell us Very briefly, what sort of proposals your members sent you to the convention with? What was the big thing on the floor that they wanted you to push?
Well, our members were we submitted a lot of proposals for our national negotiating team. The main push, our membership is probably about 60% entry level, which is the lower paid, lower benefit class of workers.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the main things that we want to see out of this contract is for two-tier wage and benefit structures to disappear from UAW contracts. Additionally, we legacy employees, legacy members haven't had a raise in 10 years. So that's also very important. We've actually lost $1 an hour because of giving up what was COLA at the time. We had $1 an hour in COLA that we gave up in 2009 during the modifications.
And what about, do the retirees figure into contract negotiations or no? Can you tell us about that?
They play both sides of the table on that. They say there's laws that prevent them from, or Supreme Court decisions that prevent them from negotiating on retirees' packages.
Mm-hmm.
Current retirees, not future retirees, but current retirees.
I see.
But at the same time, we negotiated a VEBA for retirees.
Right, right.
That's something that needs to be addressed. The VEBA was underfunded, and I'm worried that my health care benefits aren't going to be covered to the level that I expect when I retire because of it.
And can you tell us, our audience, what is VEBA? What does that stand for?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's the union has taken on the responsibility of retiree health care. In 2007 contract, the union agreed to take that responsibility off of the companies for a certain amount of cash. And they took less cash than was required to fully fund it.
Interesting. We were talking earlier about the different proposals that you were getting from your constituents at Local 551. You mentioned that legacy or traditional or seniority workers haven't had a raise in 10 years, and that newly hired workers are coming in at half the pay and benefits of traditional workers. And there's a lot of talk. I've heard a slogan, especially in UAW circles, union circles, of what they call bridging the gap. It's gained some traction in the UAW circle. What does that mean? What is bridging the gap? Did you hear that at the convention, and what exactly does that mean, and who does it pertain to?
Yes, bridging the gap was actually part of the resolution that passed at the convention. And personally, I'm unclear on what bridging the gap actually means. I offered an amendment to change that wording from bridging the gap to eliminating the gap.
Mm-hmm.
Through parliamentary procedural moves, they denied my amendment to the resolution, so it remained bridging the gap. So it's still unclear to me what exactly that means.
And was the UAW wasn't really great at articulating exactly what that means? Because I think that there's been some debate as to, how are we going to go forward on this? For example, when I spoke with Bob King, I spoke to him at the AFL-CIO convention very briefly in a brief interview in 2 years ago in Los Angeles, and I asked him, even though he wasn't going to be president, he was retiring that year. I asked him, is full parity in wages and benefits going to be gained for the newly hired workers? And he just said very simply, and he qualified the statement later on, but he just very simply said no. So full parity is not going to be gained for newly hired workers. But so I guess my question to you is, in that debate, whether we bridge the gap, as they say, and bring newly hired workers closer to traditional workers. Are we going to do that, or are we going to eliminate it entirely? Did you notice that there was some debate at the convention, and do you have a sense of where it'll go?
Well, the delegate after delegate rose to basically denounce the two-tiered wage and benefit structure, or the tiered, because there's multiple tiers at some plants. I believe the members sent them there with that message in an overwhelming sense, at least from the discussion at the convention, because so many delegates rose to speak about the two-tier, it was obviously high priority to a lot of them. So the membership is opposed to it, but as you got from Bob King in your interview with him a while ago, the leadership is going to need some prodding to get them to that position.
Mm-hmm. And I know for example, locally, at least here in Kansas City, from UAW Local 249, I am also a UAW member. I work also for Ford Motor Company. Our local union president also went to the bargaining convention, and he was quoted as saying that he wanted to end the two-tier system, that it needed to be eliminated. So I'm happy to hear that at least local leadership in Kansas City is on board, and it sounds like others are as well. But I guess my concern is we also did a show here on the Heartland Labor Forum where we brought on second-tier workers, and they said unequivocally that we are not going to sign a contract that does not completely eliminate two-tier from the 2015 contract. Is that the sense that you get from your membership in Chicago? Are they that adamant?
That's the sense that I get from my membership. Currently in the Ford system, as you may or may not know, the two-tiered or the lower-tiered percentages are like 27%, 28%
okay.
In the lower tier. So that means that a majority of the membership, at least at Ford, is the so-called legacy workers.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that a large portion of the legacy workers are not going to accept a contract that doesn't end two-tier wage and benefits either. They know that it's unfair.
Sure.
They know that it's not right. And we're all going to stand in solidarity together to try and defeat this this cancer to solidarity.
Well, I think that it was entirely clever of the auto corporations in the midst of a financial crisis. Whether that was created by the people in the industry or whether it was outside external market forces, to initiate this two-tier wage system and getting the different elements inside of the plants, inside the UAW, to start fighting one another. Do you notice a solidarity or an affinity between seniority workers and newly hired workers? Do they all seem to be on the same team? I guess maybe what I'm asking is, do you think, for example, that newly hired workers will also fight for traditional workers who, like you said, haven't had a raise in 10 years? I mean, do you think that they're together on that issue?
Well, I can tell you what I've heard and what I've seen on Facebook post is that yes, they are adamant about we all need something out of this contract. We all need to move forward in this contract.
And so, do you have any predictions? Was there a target company that the UAW was specifically going to target for a pattern agreement? Do you know?
That's only speculation at this point.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing announced as to a target company, and even if they've kind of come up with a target company, that could change between now and contract time.
Sure. And so I guess the big question that remains for us here in Kansas City, anybody else who's listening to this program, is will we see a strike in 2015? What do you think?
I think there's a stronger possibility of that now than there has been since 1976. That was the last time that The UAW took Ford out on strike, the entire company out on strike. And we've gone so far backwards, and the company is making such huge profits now that it's almost a collision course that is going to be hard to avoid. So I would recommend to all members, any members listening, to prepare. Always prepare for the worst and hope for the best. But as long as you're prepared, that gives the negotiators more power at the bargaining table. If the company knows that we're saving money to weather a strike, then they're going to think twice about putting ridiculous proposals on the table.
And were there any other proposals that weren't part of the two-tier thing that you wanted that your members wanted you to bring up at the convention? Any other smaller or more minor points?
Well, not that I personally brought up, but there was one delegate that pointed out that missing from the resolution was the cost of living allowance and the annual improvement factor. Those were not even mentioned in the resolution, and that says a lot, and it doesn't say anything good.
Okay. Well, Scott, is there anything else that you wanted to say to our Kansas City audience?
I would just say that we all, as UAW members, need to come together and prepare ourselves mentally and financially for the possibility of a strike, because it's a greater possibility in this contract negotiations than it has been at any other time. But when you come at the company from a position of strength, in other words, knowing that we've had a strong strike authorization vote, knowing that the membership is preparing, that we're getting our strike committees ready in the case that we have to take a job action, that we're just going to be it's going to make it less likely to actually strike if we're preparing in advance.
And that's about all the time that we have for tonight, folks. Scott, thank you so much. Appreciate you being on the Heartland Labor Forum with us tonight.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Take care, Scott.
Have a great night, Tino.
You too. And you have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Please stay tuned for a song from Tom Morello and then the calendar for Heartland Labor Forum by Molly Madden.
Here we go. For the fight auto workers who are twisted, tricked, and robbed. To the peasant in Guatemala in a sweatshop got your job. And she can't feed her family on the pennies that she makes. Meanwhile, the crime rate's rising up and down the Great Lakes states. Like vegetables left in the field, the signatures smell rotten. And the contracts and the deeds that push the race down to the bottom. As they load the rubber bullets, as they fire another round. I'm heading to the tear gas. Dig in, man, hold your ground. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Help! That's right. Si nos queremos juntos vamos a ganar. Si! Y'all hit them where it hurts and bite the hand that feeds. You might get 1 to 3 or probation and a fine. Well, I know where I'm gonna be. I'm gonna be right on that front line. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Yep.
dirty scabs will cross the line, while others stand aside and look. But ain't nobody never got nothing that didn't raise a voice and push. Like the steelworker in Ohio, the miner in West Virginia, the teacher in Chicago, janitor in Mississippi. From the sweatshops of L.A. to the fields of Mission Flats, there's a thundercloud exploding, and I'm free at last. Like Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. Like our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. Like the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Like the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. Like the union men and women standing up and standing strong.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for April 9, 2015. Cross-Border Network Mexican Dinner. Music by Trio Atzlan and spoken word by workers. Friday, April 10th, 6 to 9 p.m. Guadalajara Restaurant, 6224 Truman Road, KCMO. Contact crossbordernetwork.org for more info. Show Me 15 and a Union, Nationwide Day of Action for Low-Wage Workers, Wednesday, April 15th, 4 p.m. for barbecue, 5 p.m. for rally, 5:30 p.m. for march. That's at Frank A. Theus Park, 4701 Oak Street, Kansas City, Missouri, right across the street from the Nelson Art Gallery, the Nelson Atkins Museum, sorry. National Day of Action Against Fast Track and TPP, volunteers needed, Saturday, April 18th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., CWA Local 6360 at 6415 Universal Avenue, KCMO. They will be canvassing in Clay County. Call Jeff Hayes, 816-561-6360.
And you can find the rest of our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can find our archived shows, how to subscribe to the podcast, and our upcoming shows. Tune in next week. Our show is called From Public to Charter to Virtual, What's Next for the Schools? Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.